All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case this morning, 2021-744, the State of Ohio versus Tracy K. McNeil. For the appellant, Mr. Jaquith.
If I may reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. Defendants in felony cases in Ohio should not have to resort to post-trial public records requests to attempt to attain a fair retrial when they should have been granted a fair trial in the first instance. Yet that is precisely what is happening in this case. And the withheld lab reports here are evidence that any rational trier of fact would have wanted to have known before entering into deliberations. Whether the zero blood alcohol content test result is exculpatory evidence or impeachment evidence is of little or no significance because either form of evidence can serve as material evidence for purposes of a new trial motion. When confidence in the outcome of the trial is undermined by considering evidence that was not presented at trial, and if the defense had had that evidence, the trial might have...
Counsel, was the defense aware that blood draw was done at the emergency room?
I believe so, Your Honor.
So why didn't they get it?
Why didn't they get it?
Yeah.
He. First of all, apparently Dayton has open discovery, so in the regular discovery that was not provided, and then he texted the prosecutor and said, hey, do you have any of those hospital records? And the prosecutor texted back and said, no, we don't have those.
Okay, did the prosecutor have them?
The record establishes that the actual crime lab did the testing, that the report was issued to an investigating detective, and at the top of the report was the name of the detective that sat at counsel table. There's no per se evidence that the...
You don't know that it was transferred to the file of the prosecuting attorney's office, do you?
We do not know that.
Well, then how or... I mean, I'm at a loss as to... Why your position is that you were denied this by the prosecutor?
Because it is
office.
The state. That's precisely why it's the state, not the prosecution per se. So if it's in possession of the police department, which it was, which is how the public records request came to find this evidence, then Kyles versus Whitley says that whether it's in the prosecution's hands or investigating detective's hands is of no import.
Counsel, did the state reference the victim's alcohol impairment specifically in the closing argument?
Yes, and an opening statement.
So it was definitely a part of the theory of guilt here.
The opening statement made no mention of other substances. It was only alcohol.
How did the trial court come to this conclusion that, well, maybe she was impaired due to other substances?
The test results do show low levels, or what appear to be low levels of clonopin and marijuana. That didn't come out in closing argument until actually the defense mentioned that she had testified that she was on prescription clonopin, and that earlier in the evening, she's a regular user of marijuana, and B, earlier in the evening, she had smoked marijuana.
What came out at trial about her level of intoxication or her impairment?
With respect to alcohol, CR testified that she was really, really drunk, and that was the basis for the substantial impairment that the prosecution used at trial.
Was there evidence presented at trial that she had ingested any other substance that might render her impaired?
She testified that she was on prescription clonopin, that I believe, if I recall correctly, she took 3 times a day, and that she said earlier in the evening she had smoked marijuana in an unspecified amount, and that she was a daily user. to the same nurse, she denied both of those facts. She denied using marijuana and denied having any prescription medications. And I believe she said something similar to the officers on the scene, that she had not smoked marijuana that night.
And your client's defense was, what was it, me, or it was consensual, or it was, didn't happen?
Defense counsel raised several points in closing. First, there was not sufficient evidence of penetration. Second, to the extent that there was a DNA finding, that could have been through household transfer, challenged her level of impairment, because the same nurse testified that approximately 2 hours after the incident, she did not appear intoxicated at all, and the same nurse specifically testified that she would have noted that in her report. That's something she looks for.
Noted that if she had seemed intoxicated?
Yes.
Okay.
Was there corroborating evidence that of her intoxication?
There's testimony from her sister that she had apparently imbibed alcohol too quickly and thrown up and needed to be cleaned up. And yeah, the contention was that was solely related to alcohol consumption.
But the sister talked about her intoxication, the way she was acting.
Yes.
All right. And somebody attributed her vomiting because she swallowed alcohol too quickly, or she had too much?
It could be any kind of excessive alcohol consumption explanation.
So it is excessive alcohol consumption that she caused her to vomit.
That's what the state presented at trial. Yes.
Okay.
Wasn't his claim that he didn't have sex with her at all?
That was his claim. This is also an individual that had to be restored to competency before trial. And he, yes, that was his claim at the time. That was what he personally stated. Obviously, he didn't testify in the case.
But so just so to be clear, so the defense theory of the case was just challenging the sufficiency of the evidence.
I believe the state didn't
prove its case.
I believe he began his closing argument calling attention to, if I remember correctly, the statements that CR made to the same nurse when going down the same report. You know, what type of conduct happened? She specifically denied penetration occurring, and there was an option for. Don't recall. She didn't use that option. She said, and the same nurse was checking the boxes for her during the interview.
And so your appeal here really is the trial court's decision not to allow the filing of the motion. Is that correct?
Not to grant leave to file
not
a new trial motion.
Not to grant leave to file, which is a different analysis than whether a new trial should have been granted, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a more limited inquiry. Mr. McNeil was unavoidably prevented from obtaining this evidence. This court's recent holding in State versus Bethel suggests that if it cannot be demonstrated that the evidence is actually immaterial, then leave for a new trial motion should be granted.
So just so we're clear about the point, explain the difference between the standard for granting leave to file the new trial motion and granting the new trial motion.
Bethel suggests that materiality doesn't necessarily even come into the picture, but by the same token, because in Bethel there had already been a materiality analysis under the post-conviction statute, they relied on that to say that allowing Mr. Bethel to file a new trial motion would have been an act in futility, because we've already demonstrated that he wants to present inadmissible hearsay, he's already confessed, he's admitted to his girlfriend that he committed this crime. There's some possibility of a different result had a jury heard the evidence in question there.
And I don't think that quite answered my question. For the fact, what is the difference between the two different standards? Between the standard a judge applies when he or she decides whether or not to grant, to allow a new trial motion to be filed, versus the standard that's applied when the judge decides whether to grant a new trial. What's the daylight between those two standards?
Well, facially, if we look to the language of Rule 33 regarding motions regarding delayed new trial motions, Rule 33 only talks about being unavoidably prevented. There's no discussion about it. There's no provision in Rule 33 about what must be shown with respect to the evidence at the time of the filing a motion for leave to file a motion for new trial. So on the face of the motion, there needs to be no consideration of materiality at all. But Bethel and common sense kind of show us that there should be some minimum threshold facial showing in the motion for leave to file a new trial regarding materiality, that if it can't be said that it's clearly immaterial, then the case should go forward, leave should be granted to file the new trial motion, and the new trial motion be litigated.
So kind of if there's a possibility of materiality, you're allowed to file the motion, and then if it's a hearing shows it's actually material, then you get a new trial? I think courts have struggled with this as well.
It seems something in the nature of a prima facie showing. It's hard to pin down exactly what that rule should look like because it's not in the rule. I could stand up here and argue that just the showing of unavoidably prevented, regardless of the quality of the evidence, is sufficient to be granted leave. But I don't think that's going to get too far.
But is it because there's the potential Brady violation that you can kind of get past that threshold issue and look directly at the unavoidably prevented?
To my mind, the how the evidence comes into the defendant's hands comes first. So here he is unavoidably prevented, then we look to, and then if that finding's not made, then we don't need to go to the next step of potential materiality.
But just a moment ago, in answer to Justice DeWine's question, you said you actually have to look at the materiality, and I'm not sure that you do.
Again, I think there needs to be some de minimis consideration of whether this is facially, clearly immaterial. There's no reason to grant an individual leave to file a new trial motion.
And so wouldn't just the couching it as a Brady violation kind of get you there?
Yes, assuming that the argument is
has some evidence behind
has
it.
Has some sort of connection to the evidence in question, of course, yes.
Thank you.
Sure.
So when do you look at the unavoidability?
I think that's the key for delayed new trial motion practice is was Mr. McNeil unavoidably prevented, and our position is because it was in the exclusive control of the state, he was unavoidably prevented.
But the defendant knew there should be a lab report and did not demand it.
The United States Supreme Court case law is clear that it's not about the efforts made by defense. It's if it's in the possession of the state, it needs to be turned over. And he did make this specific request through the text message.
So isn't that the question? If we determine this is truly Brady material, the majority of this court recently in Bethel found that placing such a burden on the defendant is inconsistent with Brady. So if it's Brady material, we don't have to analyze that unavoidably prevented issue. Is that correct?
I'm trying to think of a scenario where that would not be true, and one's not coming to mind, so I'll answer yes.
I mean, as a trial court judge, certainly there's motions for new trials that you can examine on their face, and they're frivolous. They're not asserting any new evidence that needs to be tested as to their credibility. That's not the case in this case, is that correct?
I mean, correct, Your Honor.
There's something that directly undermines the theory of guilt that the state presented to the jury that convicted this defendant?
Yes.
So at the very least, he should have the motion for leave granted.
That's our position, Your Honor. See that? I've used my time.
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Viglucci? Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. French. I was looking at the wrong case.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. It is the state's belief that this court's decision in State v. Bethel from March effectively resolves all of the legal issues that are raised in this appeal. What remains then are questions of fact, whether or not, looking at the record as a whole, the defendant in his motion for a new trial presented material evidence that, had that evidence been available at the time of trial, would have a probability, a reasonable probability of affecting the outcome of the case. As this court said in Bethel, the evidence from Bethel was not material, was immaterial, and therefore it found that the trial court and the Court of Appeals did not abuse its discretion in denying the motion for a new trial. It is the state's position that for the same reason, this court should find that the trial court and the Second District Court of Appeals here did not abuse its discretion in denying Mr. McNeil's motion for a new trial, because the lab report was not exculpatory, was not material, had the information in that report.
Wait a second. Why, first of all, wouldn't it have been at least somewhat exculpatory? It would have called her credibility into question when she said how much she drank?
Well, perhaps it would have called into question her level of intoxication. However,
but also would have called into question not just her level of intoxication, but her testimony about how much she drank, which seems to call, then if that's called into question, it kind of calls everything into question.
Well, it's important to note that the lab report contained more than just the one line that McNeil asks this court to focus on. While it is true that the lab report indicated that there was no alcohol detected in her blood, the urine sample was positive for the presence of alcohol, as well as positive for the presence of marijuana and positive for the presence of Klonopin.
What was the level of alcohol in the urine?
I believe it was 0.06, is that correct?
Yes, 0.06 of alcohol in the urine.
So she could have driven with that level of alcohol in the urine, correct?
Well, no, not necessarily. Under a per se violation, no, she would not have been per se. But if you are under the influence of alcohol, regardless of your level, if whatever amount of alcohol you have in your system impairs your ability to drive,
but
then you're
counsel,
under the influence.
Doesn't that contradict the testimony that she was throwing up and had to be changed and put to bed?
No, not necessarily. It's important to keep in mind that the blood and urine samples were collected at approximately 4:48 a.m. The testimony was that the victim had stopped drinking and had first shown signs of extreme intoxication at approximately 9 p.m. So we're talking many hours after the fact.
But if you're defense counsel and you had this information, don't you think, wouldn't the cross-examination of her had been a lot different?
I don't necessarily know that it would have.
You don't think defense counsel would have said, well, how this says that you had no alcohol in your blood. Don't you think that would be something that would be brought up in cross-examination? Maybe defense counsel would have called an expert to talk about how alcohol dissipates.
That's possible.
If that's possible, then why shouldn't there be a hearing on it? I mean, they're not asking for us to say it's material. They're asking us first to say that this merits a hearing, right?
Well, a defendant who files a motion for a new trial based upon newly discovered evidence must first, before being entitled to a hearing, if it's a delayed motion, must first show that the new evidence is material. That is a requirement.
But if it's material, then what's the difference between that standard and the standard for granting a new trial?
Not much.
There has to be some difference, right? We have a rule that says that you can file a motion for a new trial if you're granted permission, and then the judge has to decide whether or not there has to be a hearing, decide whether or not a new trial is merited. They can't just be the same standard, can they?
Well, you're correct. They're not necessarily the same standard. What Criminal Rule 33 requires is that the defendant show that he has material new evidence that he was unavoidably prevented from discovering. If on the face of the motion and on the face of the affidavits and supporting evidence, he makes a prima facie showing that it is material, then he's entitled to a hearing. At the hearing, the weight, the merit, the credibility, the reliability of the evidence is then assessed. But
to establish whether or not it's material.
Whether it was truly material. But he at least must present some evidence initially to show that I have this evidence that I represent is material. Now, at the hearing, you can cross-examine witnesses.
When is the unavoidability determined? Whether there was true unavoidability of discovery?
It is determined at the motion for leave stage, that before a trial court can grant a defendant a motion for leave to file a delayed motion, the defendant must make a determination that the defendant was unavoidably prevented from discovering this new evidence. If the motion is filed more than 120 days after the verdict.
Did the court find that he was unavoidably prevented?
No. The court found that based upon the evidence, based upon the testimony, based upon the discovery, the defendant, McNeil, was aware that blood and urine samples were collected as part of the rape examination.
But isn't his awareness immaterial?
Well, no, because you have to show that you were unavoidably prevented from discovering the evidence within the 120 days.
Acted with due diligence
in attempting to discover it.
And asking the prosecutor for it is not due diligence?
Well,
it's the state's evidence. The state procured it. It's in the state's possession.
It is alleged that it is in the possession of the Dayton Police Department.
Well, no, even if, let's say it's not in the police department's hands. Let's say it's in the crime lab's hands. Isn't that still state possession?
No, the crime lab is not part of the state. It is an independent agency. It is not aligned with the state of Ohio, the prosecution, or any particular police department. So you say the law
only applies if indeed the prosecutor's office had this information and didn't turn it over?
Well, no. If it is in the possession of the police, that would also constitute the state for purposes of Brady.
Okay.
This report was submitted to, according to the caption, was sent to not the case detective, not the investigating detective, but an evidence technician, a police officer who had to the hospital, collected the evidence, and delivered it to the crime lab.
So is that state possession?
Yes, that would be the state's possession.
So doesn't that then fall under the case law that says you're required to turn it over to the defense?
Yes. If it is exculpatory evidence, if we're looking strictly at Brady.
But when you say exculpatory, what do you mean? Are you saying evidence that would clearly indicate lack of guilt? Because
could be used for impeachment purposes.
And as Justice DeWine just brought up, how if this is a conviction for rape based on impairment, and the primary issue is whether she was impaired, why isn't a report that talks about zero alcohol in her system some hours after the offense? Why isn't that relevant to impairment?
I do not dispute the fact that this report should have been turned over. It certainly should have been turned over. The evidence suggests that the reason the prosecutor did not turn it over is it doesn't appear the prosecutor herself was aware of it. And I say that because if the prosecutor was aware of this lab report, I would hope she would have taken advantage of the fact that the urine tested positive for alcohol, marijuana, and Klonopin, which would suggest impairment. It would have corroborated.
But is the prosecutor's knowledge of the report or lack thereof relevant?
No, it's not.
What about the U.S. Supreme Court decision of Kyles, where the prosecution has a duty to learn of any favorable evidence known to others acting on the government's behalf in the case, including the police, and to disclose that material regardless of whether it's been requested or not? How do you get around that?
I can't get around that, and that is why I agree that this report should have been turned over, that the prosecutor had an obligation to, because just like McNeil, the prosecutor was also aware that there was blood and urine samples collected at the hospital.
So if you agree to that, why don't you think it was error for the trial court not to grant the motion for leave to file?
Because whether or not the evidence should have been turned over under Brady is separate from, now we are post-conviction, it's a motion for a new trial. The defendant is entitled to a hearing on that new trial if he can show, one, unavoidably prevented from discovering, which...
But we aren't even there yet.
Right.
We're trying to get, this is a motion for leave to file a motion for a new trial.
But the defendant still must show that the new evidence is material, even at the initial stage of requesting a hearing.
But the trial court skipped. Oh, this is a two-step process.
Yes.
And the trial court just basically skipped over everything and just brought it to a close by getting to the second question without really spending much time on the first question. I mean, it's a two-step process, and the trial court skipped the first step and just went on to the second one.
I don't know that the trial court necessarily skipped the first step completely. Yes, I would agree the trial court should have spent more time analyzing the question of unavoidably prevented. I agree with that. But it did at least touch on it, and the trial court did address the materiality, which is a requirement under Criminal Rule 33.
And that's so it's a requirement for a new trial, though, right? I mean, what you said previously,
yes,
was that it was a requirement to be able to have a hearing on motion to a trial that the defendant establish materiality. If the defendant has already established that they're unavoidably prevented from discovering it and has already established its material, there's no need for a hearing then, right? I mean, what's the difference between the two standards?
Well, because on the initial motion stage, you present evidence through affidavits or in this case, attachment of the report.
So you present evidence that if believed, it would be material. And then.
Yes, and then at the hearing, you flesh out the true facts. You call the witnesses who have supplied affidavits.
Which hearing? Hearing on
the hearing on the motion for new trial. After you get past the motion for leave stage,
which we didn't get past here,
and you, I would submit you do not get past that stage here, because as the trial court found, one, no unavoidably prevented from discovering, which in light of Bethel
might be wrong,
might
you could see,
might no longer be proper law. But also found that the evidence was not material, that the defendant had not satisfied his initial prima facie requirement of submitting evidence that is material, that had this report, all things being equal, had this report been available at the time of trial, is there a reasonable probability that the outcome of the trial would have been different?
But that's not the standard for a motion for leave. The motion standard for leave is, would it have affected the jury? And there was a mistrial the first time around on this case, right?
I'm sorry?
There was a mistrial.
Yes.
So there was already some question here. It's not whether this evidence was presented on a motion for leave, because you've gone to the motion for new trial. And motion for new trial is, would the outcome have been different? But on, well, that's not the criteria for a motion for leave to file a motion for new trial.
Well, a motion for leave under Criminal Rule 33A6 begins with, when new evidence material to the defense is discovered, which the defendant could not with reasonable diligence have discovered or produced at trial, then they're entitled to a hearing. So there is a materiality requirement written into the first stage. And regardless of that, the trial court and the Second District, much as the courts did in Bethel, went beyond the motion for leave stage and addressed the, essentially the merits of the motion, in finding that this evidence, given the record as a whole, given all of the testimony given during trial as to the level of the victim's impairment, including the statements the defendant himself made to the police, which were that they were drinking and smoking marijuana and that the victim was passed out all night. That was his statement to the police. Taking that and all of the evidence as a whole, neither the trial court nor the Second District abuses discretion in finding that there was no merit to this motion and properly denying it.
Thank you.
Counsel, was there testimony as to the combination of marijuana, clonopin, and alcohol?
No.
So there's no expert testimony to say that if you're taking clonopin and it's prescribed to you, which I'm presuming it is for this victim,
yes,
that's not going to make you pass out. That's not going to make you, I mean, that's a physician-prescribed medication.
There was no testimony to that effect, no. No, only the testimony about what these witnesses observed specifically about the victim's condition, both at the time she had concluded drinking and several hours later when the police responded, they too assessed her as appearing to be under the influence.
Okay, but for the judge to say that there were other things in her system that, I mean, commenting on that,
yes.
And how did that come out? How did that?
Well, in the prosecutor's first closing arguments in summarizing the evidence.
First closing arguments.
I believe it was the first closing argument.
Closing arguments did he get?
Well, you have the prosecutor's first closing argument, okay. Then the defense, then the rebuttal.
Okay. So
Yes, the prosecutor's closing arguments, she commented that the evidence showed that not only had the victim been drinking in excess, but she had also been smoking marijuana and taking clonopin, to suggest that all of those things contributed.
And that was presented as evidence in the trial?
Well, it was presented that she had consumed alcohol, smoked marijuana, and taken clonopin. Yes, okay. It was.
Right. But your theory, though, was strictly on the alcohol. Your theory of prosecution
was strictly on the alcohol. The theory of the case was that the alcohol was the contributing, main contributing factor to her level of intoxication.
No, it was the only one that you stated in the indictment. I mean, if you had wanted to say she was sort of in an eggshell condition because she was on Klonopin and
right.
the marijuana was added to it, but you didn't. In the indictment, you just went forward on the alcohol, correct?
Well, in the indictment, it just alleges that she was substantially impaired. It did not.
But the theory of prosecution was the alcohol.
Yes, as initially presented. But again, in the closing arguments, the comment was made that in addition to the alcohol, she was on under the influence or had at least consumed marijuana and Klonopin.
Sure.
So it wasn't completely isolated.
But like the chief said, there was no expert testimony that would have helped the jury understand that they could make an inference that these other two substances enhanced the reaction that she would have to alcohol, correct?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've used your time. Counsel.
I'd just like to make two brief points. My recollection is that the state did not bring up Klonopin and marijuana until the rebuttal portion of their argument. And second, as to the timeline, the incident is alleged to have occurred in the last half hour before midnight. It is 11:30 to 11:50. The blood draw was at 3:33. I believe counsel indicated it was at 4:48, but I think 4:48 was when the detective took the sample into possession for transmitting it to the crime lab.
Mr. Jickweed, in looking at Criminal Rule 33A, The preamble says a new trial may be granted on motion of the defendant for any of the following causes affecting materially his substantial rights. So that question of materially, I think both sides agree that there is some consideration of that when you do the first part of the hearing. But we also have to look at, and I'm getting back to this Brady violation. A Brady violation means evidence that could be critical to the defense is withheld, and I mean, I would think, based on procedural due process, that goes to the substantial rights that's in that preamble. Am I correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, on the motion for leave, what is the evidentiary standard in light of Bethel? Is it still clear and convincing to show unavoidable delay?
I think that's the best answer, Your Honor. I can't think of a better one.
Okay, thank you.
And one follow-up question. During the pendency of the trial or even the appeal, would it be possible to get those records from a public records request?
Yes. In terms of the timing, once the trial is over, my understanding of Castor is that that's the demarcation point. Once the trial is over, public records request can be submitted after that.
Thank you.
The significance of the fact that the state never opposed the motion. My review of the record, he files his motion for leave for new trial, and the state does not respond.
I'm not sure how best to make a point regarding that. I certainly did note that, and the local rules call for a response within 14 days, and the court took a month to rule, so there was time to respond, but they didn't.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.